We welcome back to Chicago for his spring residency Ricardo Muti, the music director of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. And I feel confident that I can now say this in a kind of casual way, not casual, but regular, let's say, because Maestro Muti really has become already a part of the fabric in Chicago with the orchestra and here with our wonderful listeners at WFMT. So I don't think I need to make a big build-up this time, only because it's the conversation with the maestro that we look forward to, as well as his wonderful concerts. Maestro, welcome back to Chicago.
Grazie.
And I thought we might talk first a little bit about the idea of chorus and orchestra, because you are doing a program. When we're speaking, you are going into orchestral rehearsals. I'm sure there have already been many choral rehearsals. But a program that has works from very different eras and completely different styles, Cherubini, Brahms, and Arnold Schoenberg.
It's a program where, in a way, the chorus is the star, is the soloist. In fact, there are no soloists. Is a program that contains three different works from three completely different composers. The Schicksalslied of Brahms has been for a long, long time a masterpiece, very close to my heart. And I've done in many occasions, especially during several concerts for friendship that I've given around the world. And I remember the first time was in Sarajevo when we did the first concert for friendship, and the city was still immediately after the war with houses broken, people killed, not even a theater. And we performed in a stadium for 9,000 people, and the first piece was the Brahms Schicksalslied, a song of destiny. This is one of the greatest choral works of Brahms, and as much of the music of Brahms is music of consolation, like his Deutsches Requiem, Consolation for the Living. The text is from Hölderlin, very profound. Doesn't require in the audience people that believe in this God or that God. It's about our destiny, why we have to suffer so much during our life. But the introduction and the ending of the piece is of such beauty that really gives you a feeling of deep peace. Then is this piece of Schoenberg called Nidre, that is one of the most famous Jewish texts. Kol Nidre is just before the Yom Kippur, when the Jews have to repent and to eliminate or cancel all the vows, oaths, and all the commitments that they've made during the year. And so they have to eliminate these commitments just to go pure to the Yom Kippur. It's a very complicated attitude. In fact, even Schoenberg questioned when he wrote the piece about the text itself, saying why we should repent about something that we avoid. We have to avoid. So there is a sort of contradiction. But Schoenberg himself says maybe the text had a different meaning or made a different sense for the people when the text was written. But anyway,
written in a time when Jews were very frequently under persecution and duress, forced to say things, tortured even to say things.
And the piece is conceived in a very special way, with limited number of strings, very small group of strings, percussion, not loud, very delicate here and there, and many woodwinds and brass instruments. So practically, it's conceived as a chamber music, and even the chords should be limited in number. We will use a larger number, but the idea of Schoenberg is to have a limited number of singers. So it should be very intimate, the performance, even if reaches sonorities that sometimes are very aggressive and very loud. It's written also for a speaker, that is the rabbi, that has to read, not to sing, to read the text, of course, using the voice in different ways, with different tones, with different timbres, with different accents, with different loudness, but never sung the text. And then in the second part of the program, finally, I will be able to do the Cherubini Requiem in C minor with mixed chorus. I said it's in mixed chorus because then he wrote a D minor Requiem for male chorus. Apparently the reason he wrote the other Requiem for his own funeral with only male voices and without violins, so everything, the atmosphere is quite dark in sound, is because he was criticized on using female voices in the first Requiem in C minor.
Criticized for his understanding of how to compose for the female voice or for female voices?
They criticized the fact that he used female voices. For a Requiem, you know, the still was the conservative, wanted to have boys so instead of soprani, boys instead of mezzo-soprani. But Cherubini uses really soprani and mezzo-soprani, female voices. And this Requiem was written for the translation of the bodies of Louis XVI and Maria Antonietta, because Louis XVIII, that was the brother of Louis XVI, when he became king, he wanted to have the bodies of the brother and Maria Antonietta buried properly. And in fact, they are buried in the church, in the Basilica of Saint-Denis, outside Paris, where I conducted several times. And the last time I conducted the Cherubini Requiem in Paris was in Saint-Denis, exactly where Cherubini himself conducted this.
The tombs of all of these kings and others.
With head, with head, without head, with the basilica is extremely impressive. One of the greatest churches in France, and so it was very emotional for me to conduct the Requiem, staying exactly where Cherubini himself conducted the piece. And apparently the entire church was covered with black curtains. I mean, must have not been a very happy atmosphere. And the Requiem in C minor was very much praised by all the composers, the great composers of the time, including Beethoven. That was Beethoven not only was a great admirer of Cherubini, actually, he wrote to Cherubini, I consider you the greatest composer of our time. But Beethoven, he said that if one day he had to write a Requiem, he would have the C minor Requiem of Cherubini in front of him as an example of how to do the Requiem. Like when he wrote Fidelio, he had the Lodoisca, the opera of Cherubini that I conducted in La Scala and even recorded there, as an example to follow when including the Singspiel of Lodoisca that is applied also for Fidelio. Now, we know that Brahms had a great admiration for Cherubini. In fact, in his room, in his studio, in his office, Brahms had only three images of great composers, Bach, Beethoven, and Cherubini. So many people ask me, so why Cherubini is not popular? There are many answers. The most easy is the fact that Cherubini is a composer that wrote music for the musicians, for the music. As I said in other occasions, like the logo of the Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, under the lion, it's written Ars Gratia Artis. That means art for the sake of art. And Cherubini never tried to write music to please the public or to impress the public. Even in Medea, that is his masterpiece, and it's a very difficult and hard opera to perform and to sing. So his music also has a style that is very difficult to identify, because it's not Mozart, it's not Cimarosa, it's not Rossini, doesn't belong to the German tradition or the Austrian tradition, not even to the French tradition, because he was director of the Conservatorio in Paris, where he had as a pupil Berlioz, and he had fight with Berlioz all the time, because they represented two completely different worlds. So its style is neoclassic, but what is neoclassic? How to define neoclassic in music? So certainly the lines must be very pure, the musical lines. It's not romantic, so we cannot exaggerate in sentimentality or sentiment. And it's not absolutely classic in the sense of Mozart or before Mozart. We consider Cherubini the Canova in music, Canova, the great Italian sculptor of the same period. So practically we have to identify we have to discover the fire in the marble. This is the best definition that was made about Cherubini. So there is a fire, outside is a sort of marble. In a way, the two neoclassic composers are Cherubini and Spontini. Spontini, the composer of La Vestale, of Agnes von Hohenstaufen. But Spontini goes even more in the direction of Romanticism. Cherubini remains neoclassic. And certainly the fact that Beethoven admired him so much depends on the fact that Cherubini impresses us today not so much for the beauty of his melodies, but for the structure, the architecture of his works, of his operas and his symphony and his message, etc. That's the reason why Beethoven, that was also an architect in music, admired so much Cherubini.
It does happen in any field, doesn't it, that there are figures of great importance who lay out structures, rules, influences. Often these are pedagogues as well, or even primarily. And sometimes it takes another artist, another composer or architect or painter in that field to point to and understand the greatness of this contribution, because it helps to make their own development possible.
Sì, certo.
What does Cherubini do with text? How does he choose his text for this Requiem?
But it's the usual text.
So he's not upsetting the cart the way Brahms
does with
the German Requiem.
No. So the program will be for the people that don't believe in this or that God, that is Brahms. For the Jews that believe in their God and in their theory and their religion, and for the Christians. So I hope that everybody will be happy in the end.
We're speaking with Riccardo Muti, music director of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra in Chicago in early March for 2 weeks of concerts. We've already had Brahms and Brahms, and now we are looking forward, when we're speaking, to Cherubini, Schoenberg, and Brahms again.
Thank you.
Maestro, I don't want to ask you to be overly personal or to invade any personal part of you, but I do want to ask, just in historical terms, did religion play a role in your life, in your development, in your family life when you were a child and a young man?
Not directly. But indirectly, yes, because when I started to play the violin, and I started because my father wanted all five brothers' sons to study music as education, as part of our culture. So I happened to receive a violin as a gift that meant that I had to study the violin. And I was not so happy, you know, because I would have preferred to play football and to do other things. And my first concert publicly was when I was 8 years old, and was in the, I don't know if in English you say seminary.
Yes.
Where the priests become priests.
Yes.
And at that time there was a very important, it's still now, is in Molfetta, near Bari, this seminary with many young
Puglia
priests.
Region.
Puglia, yeah. This is the seminary of the entire region mm-hmm. of Puglia. And the dean of the seminary was a priest, very intelligent, that then became cardinal in mm-hmm. Napoli. And he loved music very much, and he gave me the possibility to play my first concert at the age of 8 years. So that's the reason, religion indirectly, because I played in front of an audience that was very much connected with the relatives of the young priest, etc., etc. But since then I was independent completely. But I was very close to the. Religious music was part of our education, because Napoli, the conservatorio in Napoli that comes, was the result of the four big musical schools in Napoli that then in the 17th and the 18th century were the big schools, were Scarlatti, Porpora, Cimarosa, Paisiello, Hasse. They were students and they taught. They were unified in the conservatorio. And so these schools were very much connected also with the tradition for the young students, Pergolesi, Cimarosa, to sing in the churches. So they wrote a lot of religious music. And in any case, the church had great influence on the composers, commissioning and a lot of religious music. And in fact, without the church, the history of music in Italy would have been extremely different. And this is something that the actual church has forgotten.
Let me come back to that in just a moment, because you've had some public statements to make on that very important subject. But just in terms of thinking this through, we see the same thing, of course, in art. Whatever the individual views of Michelangelo, Leonardo, Raffaello, even Tiziano, Tintoretto, the language they worked in and the commissioners of so much of their work was going to be the church. And so it doesn't mean they are this pious or this impious, but that they are working in a language, and they are using that then to develop the progression of art itself, and
yeah.
These are the
also. We
parallels.
Must not forget that until the middle of the 19th century, the Pope was a king,
yeah,
and so he was the king of a state,
right.
And in fact, in the region where I live, in Romagna. That where Ravenna, it's part of Romagna. That region was under the Pope for centuries, and that's the reason why the priests many times are not very popular now in that area of Italy.
You know, in English we use the Latin word of philanthropist. In German they use Maecenas. They use a king. who is commissioning art.
And the Pope, the insistence of certain popes on Raphael or Michelangelo especially, we would not have all the works of art that we have today. Look, the Vatican, is the result of love of different popes for art and for the music. So Palestrina, Luca Marenzio, Orlando di Lasso, without the influence of the insistence of the certain popes, they would have not written what they wrote.
But something then happens in the 20th century, not only after the Second Vatican Council, but in general. On the one hand, this idea, I would say as a complete outsider, but a legitimate idea that the church should connect to people, but this idea that it won't connect to people if it uses the great music of the past. What happens there? Why do when you walk into a church and you hear somebody playing guitar who doesn't even play the guitar particularly well? Guitar is a fine instrument. Berlioz played it too. Yeah. But why turning it back on all of this history of music?
I've been very critical in my country about this.
In front of cardinals and so on.
Si, si. But the fact is not the only that they play with this. It's not the guitar, as you said, itself, the instrument, but the way they use in a very amateur, dilettante way, and the text also that they sing sometimes is so stupid and so superficial. And so, of course, we don't have to sing Dante in the church, but sometimes it's better. The Ave Verum of Mozart would be wonderful for any religion, you know.
Absolutely.
Because, it seems that everything is going in a wrong direction. We don't want to think, not only to sing, to think anymore. And anything that is superficial and gives us a superficial pleasure to our ears and doesn't make us thinking, then it's fine. But this is a problem not only in the church, it's the society that is going in this
one
direction.
One is reflecting the other back and forth, probably.
And if we don't go back to recuper, to take back some values, human values, then it will be really a disaster in the world for the future.
Has there been reaction, other than immediate reaction, of course, newspaper articles, headlines, radio programs, some panel discussions, but has there been formal reaction to some of the comments that you've made when you've received degrees or honors and brought this to the attention? I know whether because of you or on his own initiative, the Pope, the current Pope, whose background is German and who has a great love of music, apparently plays the piano, he made a statement himself that something needs to be done. I'm not sure if anything has been done.
Yeah, but I was not following his statement because I did this even before this Pope that is very musically cultivated. Actually, in May, I will do a concert for the Pope in Roma. And I will do the Magnificat of Vivaldi and Verdi Stabat Mater and Te Deum in the Sala Nervi in the Vatican. And actually, this will be one, two, the third or the fourth Pope. Because the first Pope in front of whom I conduct a concert was Paul the VI.
Yes.
And I was 23 years old, and I conducted the music of Scarlatti as a student of a conservatory in Milano. But all these popes have been very much culturally involved. This one is very special because he is a musician.
Yes.
Jean-Paul II, I played concerts for him, the Bach Hamol Messe, the Bimanol Messe, etc. But he was much more open to other possibilities of light music. Rightly so, he thought that pop music or folk music could have a certain influence on putting people together. And I agree on this, but only that in some churches I've heard some people playing and singing so badly. And I don't mean that we have to be like the Austrians and the Germans, that sometime in their churches they have such a discipline, and they sing so well that sometimes seems to be in a concert hall. Yes. And I prefer also a certain way, Italian way, that is a little bit like, you know, a little bit less
formal.
And in fact, the difference between the Austrian and German religious music and Italian music, religious music like Rossini, Stabat Mater, or Verdi, Requiem, is that we speak to God like man to man, person to person. Mm-hmm. And this is nice because sometimes you need to feel that God is like you, no? that you can insult him also.
Surely.
It's, like they do in Napoli with San Gennaro, that is right. The patron of Napoli, and when he doesn't liquefy his blood, all the people in the church start to call him with bad names. And in fact, sometimes I think that the blood liquefies just because the saint has receives enough insults.
And of course, we see this in the cantorial and Jewish tradition where we were speaking of the si. Schoenberg and in Fiddler on the Roof and Tevye and these tales. Any folk peoples, I think, try to find that immediate connection with the Creator.
Thank you.
We're speaking with Ricardo Muti, generally speaking, taking off from some repertoire. And to round out this conversation, I want to ask you also, Maestro, you know, as with many people who visit Italy who are not from Italy and who are not of Italian background, I could understand certain places right away when I went there, or felt I understood. You go to Florence, you feel the Renaissance. You go to Milan, you feel commerce, you feel certain things. Rome, how do I get my head around this everything? And for me, the insight, as I think it was for many people, was to remember that Rome is about layers, and things are happening, layers of time and also layers of orientation. And so you have, of course, the Vatican, and you have the religious history, but you also have the personal histories, and you, of course, have the great history of the Romans and of the empire and of philosophy and literature, and all of these things are layered and then become intermingled. In addition to your musical studies, you did a full course of philosophy and what we would call classics, I guess, in this country, and that obviously had a role in shaping who you are.
See, I didn't finish my studies in philosophy because then I was involved in music so much that I didn't have time to complete the studies. But I've been always very much involved in the humanistic studies. And actually, I am much more involved in the Roman and Greek literature than in pure philosophy. Actually, you know, philosophers always scare me somehow because they
maybe they're going too deep or
too far.
Too far, yes.
And my studies in philosophy they helped me in the aesthetic. I don't know if you say the same word. In the understanding certain aspects of musicology and
what was the word you were going to use?
Aesthetica.
Aesthetics.
Aesthetics, yeah. That is the, Immanuel Kant, right. He did la morale, l'estetica, e la ragione. I don't know how
morals,
to say.
Morals, aesthetics, religion.
Sì. Yeah. Ragione, reason.
Morals, of course, Kant. The critique of practical reason, the critique of pure reason, but intellect.
La ragione pura, sì, the pure. And the fact that I was born in the south, in a city like Napoli, where you can really, like Roma, but even more in Napoli, you can witness the history of mankind since 2,000-3,000 years before Christ to the actual contemporary period. And you can see in the city, the architecture, in the archaeology, the museums, all the elements that have been the history of the city. This is, I think, that for me it's essential for my life. For example, the last time I was in Napoli, I went to the Museo Nazionale, that is one of the most important archaeological museums in Italy. And when you say in Italy, you say practically in the world. To see all these Roman huge statues that they had found and all the paintings of Pompeii, all the things, you realize the roots of where you are coming. And I think that you can follow century by century the entire history of mankind until your period. And And so that makes me always thinking when I hear outside of Italy the people saying, you know, the Italians, generalizing the Italians. Mm-hmm. Who are the Italians? I cannot even say the Neapolitans, mm-hmm. because if you think that Napoli is the result of so many different dominations, you know, from before were the Greek before, then there were the Romans. And then you had the Arabs, and then the Normans, and then the Schwaben, and then the Aragonese, the Spanish, the Austrians. So that, in fact, we say in Napoli that because when we speak, we use very often the hands. You know, mm-hmm. the Italians use the hands, especially in the south. We use too much the hands. I think that this depends on the fact that comes from the fact that sometimes the dominations succeeded one after the other so quickly that every time the people learned how to say bread in one language, and then came another domination, they had to change it. And so it was much easier to make a gesture with the hand to say, I am hungry, than to use the words. Well, but it's so complex. Roma, for example, every corner is like an opera, mm-hmm. The stage of an opera, and the same Napoli. I am Neapolitan, and I have studied there. And if somebody asks me who is a Neapolitan, I don't know really the definition of because we are. Everything at the contrary of everything, and this is also the interesting aspect of and sometimes the brilliance of the intelligence of the population. No, that's mm-hmm. so because it's the result of so many influences and cultures all together.
And when we next speak in Chicago, at least, you will have been back to Napoli with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra making its first concert.
Yeah, the first appearance of Chicago Symphony in Napoli, Teatro San Carlo, that Stendhal, when he saw the Teatro San Carlo, he said, this is the most beautiful theater in the world, and it is. And so if you think that on that stage, Cimarosa, Paisiello, Rossini was the artistic director for several years in San Carlo, Donizetti, it's 1737 this theater was built by the Bourbons, Carlo III of Bourbon, Charles III of the Bourbon, and has an history that many premieres of Rossini, Donizetti, Bellini, yes. Verdi took place in that theater. So I'm very anxious to bring the Chicago Symphony there. For me, it would be a very emotional because in that theater, in that hall, I experienced my first. The first time that I heard Beethoven or Puccini or Verdi when I was 15, 16 years old. So to go back with this great orchestra would be really an important experience in my life.
And I know an important experience for the orchestra and the audiences as well as really any appearance by Riccardo Mutius, but especially this homecoming and this bringing everything full circle from Chicago to Naples. Maestro Muti, thank you so much for talking with us.
Grazie, grazie. Thank you very much.
religion. At the beginning, God crushed that light to atoms. Myriads of sparks are hidden in our world, but not all of us behold them. The self-glorious, who walk arrogantly upright, will never perceive one. But the meek and modest, eyes downcast, he sees it. A light is sown for the pious. V'yeshivo shel Malo, uv'yeshivo shel Mato. In the name of God, we solemnly proclaim that every transgressor, be it that he was unfaithful to our people because of fear, or misled by false doctrines of any kind out of weakness or greed, we give him leave to be one with us in prayer tonight. A light is sown for the pious. A light is sown for the repenting sinner. All nidre, all vows, oaths, promises, and plights of any kind, wherewith we pledge ourselves counter to our inherited faith in God.
Music we heard this evening included the opening portion of the 1938 Kol Nidre setting by Arnold Schoenberg. We heard that in a recording from the 1980s, the early 1980s, by Pierre Boulez, the BBC Chorus and Orchestra, and narrator John Shirley Quirk. We heard the opening portion as well of the Song of Destiny, the Schicksalslied of Brahms, Bruno Walter, in a recording from 1961, the Columbia Symphony Orchestra with the Occidental College Consort. And we heard the Sanctus and Pie Jesu from the Cherubini Requiem in C minor, the recording made 30 years ago. That's by a 40-year-old Riccardo Muti, the Philharmonia Orchestra London, the Ambrosian Singers. We'd like to thank Riccardo Muti for his time. This interview was recorded on Sunday afternoon, March 11th, 2012, in downtown Chicago. We'd like to thank Eric Arunas for recording that interview, Matt DeStefano for editing and producing and making the program sound great, Rachel Alexander and Emily Master for arranging our interview. We'd like to thank our funders, Alphawood Foundation, Dick and Susie Kiphart, and other friends of this program. Let us know what you thought about this or any of our other programs. Drop us a line, Rentap, Patner spelled backwards, R-E-N-T-A-P at AOL.com, or click on the Chime In feature at WFMT.com. And a reminder, you can go anytime to WFMT.com/critical thinking and hear this or any of our other programs again on the always free and popular Critical Thinking podcast. I'm Andrew Patner. We'll see you next week.